And I'll invite you this morning to take your Bibles and turn to the 38th chapter of Genesis. Genesis chapter 38. I believe it's somewhere around page 62 if you're using your pew Bible. You may have passed her on the street just the other day. Her countenance was drawn. She was tired. There was that hollow look in her eyes. It was obvious. The one time she had been stunningly beautiful, but the years, and more specifically the disappointments, had drawn the life from her. And now she was just a shadow of what was once an attractive woman. You notice that she didn't look you directly in the eye. In fact, she flinched and withdrew from your gaze. And as you walked on your way, you sort of wondered what her story was. But it was a day for keeping schedules. It was a day for getting your to-do list done, for meeting deadlines, for running errands. It wasn't a day for hearing stories. But God knows her story, just as God knows all of our stories. And he tells us her story in Genesis 38. It's the story of one by no fault of her own found herself mistreated, neglected, and virtually forgotten. It's the story of someone who in desperation sought justice for herself. It's the story of one who, despite all of the misfortunes in life, found that God is a God of compassion who doesn't forget, doesn't neglect, and doesn't mistreat. Her name is Tamar. And in this chapter of Genesis 38, we will learn her story. She's only mentioned two places in the entire Bible. Here in Genesis 38, and then in Matthew chapter 1, she's mentioned again. And yet she, as a Canaanite woman, far from anything that God had chosen, from anyone that God had chosen in one sense, far from worshiping God, was a woman that God used to bring about his purposes in an amazing way. So let me give you some understanding of this chapter. I'm going to share with you the story that is, as it unfolds in this chapter, and then we're going to finish everything up today with some takeaway lessons, some things that we can take with us. Genesis 38, chronologically, does not happen in a vacuum. One of the things that's very difficult about telling stories is trying to put them together. So if you were doing the movie of Joseph's life, and that has been done, you would have Joseph being taken off to Egypt, and Judah and his brothers all going back and bringing the ornate robe that was now bloodstained by one of Judah's own goats, back to, or Jacob's own goats, back to him. And you would have this whole scene taking place. And in chapter 38, Judah actually moves away. And some believe that chapter 38 happens right at the end of Joseph being taken into Egypt and goes for 25 years. And chapter 38 chronologically doesn't end until you get between Genesis 42 and 43. So it's not this little microcosm thing that happens, boom, it's done. It takes time. Verse 38, verse 1 says, at that time Judah left his brothers and went down to stay with a man of Adullam named Hira. There Judah met the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua. He married her, made love to her, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son who was named Ur. She conceived again and gave birth to a son and named him Onan. She gave birth to still another son, named him Shelah. It was at Kazib that she gave birth to him. Judah does something that is unprecedented. He moves away. In that culture, you did not move away from your family. You stayed within the family. You stayed involved. But Judah moves away. Not only does he move away, there's no indication that he has an inheritance. There's no indication that he has his father's blessing. There's no indication that this is kind of branching out and expanding the family business. He actually moves away and becomes a hired hand. He works for another man, and he stays with him. He becomes part of his household. Judah is singled out here because of his status. Reuben, we had already seen, has lost his status as the firstborn, the birthright. Levi and Simeon lost theirs by slaughtering an entire town. Judah's next in line. Did he move away to kind of protect himself? Did he move away because he was just totally bothered by what had happened with Joseph and his part in it? We don't know. We just know that he moves away. And he marries a Canaanite. Now understand that while God doesn't say anything specifically about that in this particular passage, God's plan was for his nation not to intermingle, especially with the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Perizzites and the other ites. Personally, I believe one of the reasons that God told Abraham that his people would move down to Egypt, I believe one of the reasons they moved down are a couple of hints in the text. As you get later on in Genesis, you'll find that the Egyptians will not eat with a Hebrew. You get later on in the text, you'll find that the Egyptians despise shepherds. They think they are detestable. So it's very possible that God allowed his nation to go down into Egypt, as we will see as we move on through this book, to protect them from intermingling, because the Canaanites didn't care. But Judah marries a Canaanite. Judah's life continues on. His sons grow up. He gets to the point where he can afford the bride price, and he goes out and he gets a bride for his son, Ur. Chapter 38, verse 6. Judah got a wife for Ur, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. But note this description of Judah's son. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the Lord's sight. So the Lord put him to death. Ur was wicked. The word that's translated wicked could be translated evil. It could be translated someone who actively gives pain. It could be translated vicious. It could be translated injurious. Ur was not a good man. And oftentimes when I've read this, I just scratch my head and I think, how bad? I mean, I've known some bad people. Maybe you've known some bad people. How bad? How evil? How wicked does a person have to be for God to step in and say, I'm done with you. You no longer get the privilege of living on this earth. This was a really evil guy. And we won't go into, because it's not the place, of maybe how Judah failed as a parent. But we do see that this was a bad guy, and God kills him. He literally wipes him off the face of the planet. We don't know. We don't know what Tamar had to suffer at the hands of this man. We don't know what others had to suffer at the hands of this individual. But all we know is God refused to allow the sin exhibited by the life of this man to continue. Please take this passage at face value. Don't start making your list of people that you think are worthy. Don't start making your list of people that maybe you ought to start praying, hey, God, you know what you did in Genesis 38, 6? I got a list. Here's some people. It's an isolated incident for an isolated time. Now, there was a custom. There was a custom in the land that existed long before God put it into law in Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 and 6. It's a custom called levirate marriage. And what that meant was that if a man like Judah has a son and that son gets married, but he dies before Tamar can have a son, then his brother is to take Tamar, his sister-in-law, to be his wife, and he is through her to produce an heir for the family. So Judah does the right thing. He takes Tamar and gives her to Onan as his wife, and Onan is supposed to produce an heir through Tamar, who will be the firstborn, and Onan will then share some of the inheritance with him. The only thing that makes Onan a little bit better than his brother Ur is that he gets to live a little bit longer. Verse 8, Judah says to Onan, sleep with your brother's wife, fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to raise up offspring for your brother. But Onan knew that the child would not be his. So whenever he slept with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from providing offspring for his brother. What he did was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death also. Onan is a selfish and deceitful person. On the surface, he accepts responsibility. On the surface, he brings Tamar into his household as his wife. But he will not allow her to become pregnant because he does not want to have a son that would go for his brother. He does not want to share the inheritance. So he enjoys all of the pleasures of intimacy with her without taking any of the responsibility. And God says, strike two. And he puts him to death. Judah is kind of freaking out right now. And so he, on the surface, says some good things. Verse 11, he says to his daughter-in-law Tamar, live as a widow in your father's household until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought he may die too, just like his brothers. So Tamar went to live in her father's household. In other words, Judah isn't smart enough to step back and go, maybe there's something more going on here. He says, you go live like a widow in your father's household. So go back to your dad's house, live off of the bride price, live there, and when my third son gets old enough, we'll make sure that you have an heir. And he's thinking, man, this woman is bad news. Two of my sons have died in relationship with her. I'm hoping maybe she forgets all about this and I don't have to do this. And life goes on. Life goes on, and verse 12 says, after a long time, we don't know how long, a long time, Judah gets married. His son Ur gets old enough to have to be married. He finds a wife. His next son is old enough to be married. There's this long time that goes by. Some believe that Genesis 38 spans upwards to 25 years or more. But after a long time, Judah's wife, the daughter of Shua, dies. When Judah had recovered from his grief, he went up to Timnah to the men who were shearing his sheep, and his friend Hira the Adullamite went with him. And here the story shifts. The story shifts to focusing just on Tamar. You see, here's her situation culturally. She has no husband, no children. She is at that lowest point of life in the Old Testament. If you read through the Old Testament, you see that time and again, God tells his people, take care of the widow, the orphan, and the stranger. The widow and the orphan and the stranger were the most vulnerable in society. There was no life insurance. There was no way to go and get a job. A widow needed either a son who had grown enough to have his own household, or some means to take care of her. She's trapped in a series of unfortunate events. And there's a sense in which Tamar is truly a victim. She has had no say in the choices that have been made for her, and here she is. Tamar decides to take matters into her own hands. Remember, what Tamar does not know, she does not know God's promise to Abraham. She does not know that God has a plan to create a nation through Jacob. She doesn't know that. She has no clue. Nobody at this point in biblical history has a clue that someday there's going to be a Messiah to come out of the line of Judah to redeem all of us. She has no clue about that. She knows one thing. By some way, shape, or form, this man is going to see to it that I have an heir to take care of me in my old age. Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is on his way to Timnah to shear sheep." She took off her widow's clothes, covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, and then sat down at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that though Shelah had now grown up, she had not been given to him as his wife. Judah has not fulfilled his promise. Now, before you are tempted to call Tamar an immoral woman, keep in mind, we have no clue that she's been raised to follow the God of heaven. We have no idea. In fact, we can probably surmise that her father-in-law has really not set a good example of godliness for her. And the law of the land and the custom, the Levirate law, is clear that if Judah doesn't give her Shelah, then Judah himself must be the one to provide an heir through Tamar. And she knows that that ain't happening. The very sad reality is Judah is less concerned with his family line than he is with Tamar. And for our purposes, he becomes an obstacle to the promise of God and to the covenant. Remember, at this moment, the covenant, from a human perspective, is at risk. God's promise is at risk. So Judah comes along, and this kind of tells you about who Judah is. Verse 15, Judah saw her. He thought she was a prostitute, for she'd covered her face. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over by the roadside and said, "Come now, let me sleep with you." And she says, "What will you give me to sleep with you?" "I'll send you a young goat from my flock," he said. "Will you give me something as a pledge until you send it?" she asked. He said, "What pledge shall I give you? Your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand," she answered. So he gave them to her and slept with her. She became pregnant by him. And after she left, she took off her veil, put on her widow's clothes again. Judah's not thinking right. She says, "Give me your seal and the cord that it has, and give me your staff." Let me put that in 21st century terms. She said, "Give me your driver's license and a major credit card." That's basically what she said. And he said, "Okay." He gave her his driver's license and a major credit card. And then he goes on his way and she goes on her way. He gets to his flock. He says, "Hey, take this goat. Take it down and give it to that prostitute down the way." And his friend takes the goat, figuring it was a shrine prostitute, which again, if Judah thought that she was a temple prostitute, then he's not even thinking about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's thinking about, oh, if I go into this temple prostitute and I worship her God through a sexual encounter, then he'll bless my sheep shearing and everything. And they go and they can't find the prostitute. Nobody knows what they're talking about. And Judah realizes he's got to go down to the DMV and get a new driver's license. I mean, the seal was so personal. And he goes, "Okay, we're not going to look for anymore because people, they'll laugh at me." 3 months go by. 3 months go by and Judah gets word. "Judah, your daughter," verse 24, "your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution and now she's pregnant." And Judah goes off. Now, it's very interesting. She's living in her father's household, but somehow he still has the say-so in this. And he says, bring her out and have her burned to death. He's still angry that he lost two sons because of this woman. Now he's going to have her wiped out. They go get Tamar. They're bringing her out. She goes, well, you need to send a message to this man. She pulls out his driver's license and his credit card. She says, the guy that owns these is the man who's responsible for my pregnancy. And Tamar is vindicated. Verse 26, Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son Shelah. And he did not sleep with her again. She's more righteous than I, Judah says. All of a sudden, Judah begins to be humbled just a little bit. I didn't keep my word. I didn't do what was right. I believe Judah takes her back into his household and provides for her. When the time came, verse 27, for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. As she was giving birth, one of them put out his hand. So the midwife took a scarlet thread and tied it on his wrist and said, this one came out first. But when he drew back his hand, his brother came out and she said, so this is how you have broken out. His name was Perez. Then his brother, who had the scarlet thread on his wrist, came out and he was named Zerah. And the story ends there. And we're going, okay, this is different. But the story doesn't end there. Before I give you four things that we can take home, turn to Matthew chapter 1. Matthew begins his gospel with a genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah. Matthew does something that was unheard of in genealogies. There are five women listed in the genealogy of the Messiah. Follow along as I read, beginning in Matthew 1:1. This is the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. You see, God was at work in spite of Judah. God was at work in spite of the horrific things that had been done. God was at work. Remember, I told you, the Bible is a book about God. It's a book about God and His work. What can we learn from this passage about God? Couple of things. First of all, God's justice is inescapable. God may not take the life of one who has harmed you or mistreated you, but learn from these few verses that nothing escapes the gaze of our God. And that's even those of us who think we're most of the time good, but some of the times not. Nothing escapes the gaze of our God. He is fully aware, and when the time is right, God will act. God's justice is inescapable. The truth is not just for the one who's been hurt. It's for the one who's delivered the pain. None of us will escape the arm of the Lord. Here's the second one. God shows mercy to the disenfranchised. A disenfranchised person is a person who's been deprived of power, a person who's been deprived of rights and privilege. Tamar is a disenfranchised person. Don't for a minute think that this plan that we see that unfolds in Genesis 38 is God is like, woo, what a great plan, good job. No, this was not God's design, it was not God's best. Tamar had no idea of the grand design of which she was a part. But God worked through a desperate and abused and neglected lady. And God showed mercy to her because God shows mercy to the disenfranchised. Judah had so many options before him. Judah was a man of privilege. Judah was part of the house of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Judah was part of Israel. Judah had so much. Judah was under the blessing of Abraham, where God said, I will bless you and I will make you a great nation, and everyone who blesses you, I will bless. Judah was part of that. And he walked away from it. And he kind of fades into the background a little bit for the rest of Genesis. But it's through Judah that the Messiah came. It's through Judah that Jesus came. God still used him. And that would not have happened, humanly speaking, had Tamar not said, I demand justice and you will give it to me. Learn from Judah's mistake and strive to be a person of obedience, because know this, God always finds someone to carry out his will. God has chosen for reasons only beknownst to him to work through us, human instruments. And if you and I choose not to obey God and not to follow his call in our life, he lets us go, because he will always find someone. The fourth lesson in this is all about grace. I was with a friend recently, and they were saying, they tried to tell me that there wasn't a lot of grace in the Old Testament. And boy, I didn't come unglued, but I reminded them that they were gravely mistaken. God's grace is in this passage. God's grace is for everyone. Don't forget the grace of God. What we did here in communion today and remembering that, it's all about God's grace. It's his grace, his gift to us. Don't forget God's grace. You and I are here today because of the grace of God. You and I would have no eternity, no hope for eternity, except for the grace of God. Some of us know we can look back. It's not fun to look back, because you look back and you see where you made desperate, foolish, painful decisions. It's very possible that some of us are paying for those decisions yet today and the consequences. And yet, there's a God of grace who says, I forgive you. There's a God of grace who says, I love you. There's a God of grace who says, I paid for it already. There's a God of grace who says, I'll walk with you through it. Because of God's grace shown through a desperate woman demanding justice, the Messiah came through that line. It can be traced back. Because of God's grace, you and I can have relationship with him. Because of God's grace, you and I can change. We can move on. We can be useful. Maybe today you're feeling the way I've described Tamar. Maybe today you're feeling desperate, alone, forgotten, neglected. Maybe today you're sitting there thinking that you've got a plan, just like Tamar had a plan, that you've got a plan, you're going to carry it out, and you are going to get justice for yourself. Know this, that is not God's best. Tamar's appearance in the genealogy of Jesus is there not because she was wily or courageous or demanded justice. Tamar appears in the genealogy of Jesus simply because of the grace of God. He's the answer. He is always the answer. Would you stand as we pray? Father, I thank you for your word this morning and for just that stunning reminder that you are constantly involved in the goings-on of life, that you are aware, and that sometimes you work in amazing ways through the disenfranchised. Thank you for Tamar. Thank you for showing her grace. Thank you for showing Judah grace. Thank you for showing us grace. May we live our lives in light of your grace, not taking advantage of it, but remembering that it is the motivation for us to walk in obedience. In Jesus' name, amen.